Good morning, everybody, and welcome to Sun Sounds of Arizona. The program is Business World, and I'm Steve Klein. We're going to do a few articles on the conflict between the Federal Reserve and President Trump. The question is this: should the Federal Reserve maintain complete independence from the executive branch of government? Here's the first article. Powell blasts DOJ criminal probe as an attack on Fed independence. Public service sometimes requires standing firm in the face of threats. This is by Jason Moff with Fortune Magazine, and it's dated January 12th. Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell called out the Trump administration for attacking the central bank's independence, saying a criminal probe is due to the Fed's refusal to lower rates earlier this year, as President Donald Trump demanded. He said in a statement Sunday that the Justice Department served the Fed with grand jury subpoenas, threatening a criminal indictment over his testimony before the Senate last June related to renovations on the headquarters, which has seen cost overruns. Powell, who is typically cautious in his public remarks, was clear that the probe was political in nature and had nothing to do with the Fed renovations or his testimony, dismissing them as pretexts. The threat of criminal charges is a consequence of the Federal Reserve setting interest rates based on our best assessment of what will serve the public, rather than following the preferences of the president, he wrote. This is about whether the Fed will be able to continue to set interest rates based on evidence and economic conditions, or whether instead monetary policy will be directed by political pressure or intimidation. Powell added that he served under Republican and Democratic presidents without political fear or favor, while focusing on the Fed's dual mandate of price stability and maximum employment. Public service sometimes requires standing firm in the face of threats, he said. I will continue to do the job the Senate has confirmed me to do with integrity and a commitment to serve the American people. The statement came as the New York Times reported that the U.S. Attorney's Office in the District of Columbia has opened a criminal investigation into Powell and whether he lied to the Senate Banking Committee about the scope of the renovation project, which has grown to $2.5 billion. Jeanine Pirro, a longtime Trump ally, who's in charge of the D.C. Federal Prosecutor's Office, signed off on the probe, sources told the Times. For his part, Trump told NBC News that he didn't know about the DOJ subpoenas. I don't know anything about it, but he's certainly not very good at the Fed, and he's not very good at building buildings, he said, referring to Powell. For a full year now, the market has heard threats about Fed independence, and it consistently shakes them off. But at some point, there will be a breaking point. Christopher Hodge, chief U.S. economist at NetTexas CIB Americas, told Fortune via email, "Straws don't break camels' backs. Incremental weight does." He also pointed out that if Powell is implicated in the probe, then the whole board will likely be implicated as well, resulting in an erosion of the Fed as a credible policymaking institution. Hodge, who previously served as principal economist at the New York Fed, said based on the administration's, the DOJ inquiry is another straw on the back of the camel. The subpoena marks Trump's latest attack on Powell and the Fed, which he harangued for months because it didn't lower interest rates sooner. And when it did start easing in September, Trump said it should cut rates more. In addition to the verbal attacks, Trump considered firing Powell and threatened to sue him over the renovation costs. Trump is also still attempting to remove Governor Lisa Cook after announcing her dismissal last year over alleged mortgage fraud. She has denied the accusation and challenged her firing. The case is now before the Supreme Court. Meanwhile, Powell's term as Fed chair expires in May, and Trump has said he already has someone in mind to replace him. Top candidates are Governor Christopher Waller, National Economic Council Director Kevin Hassett, and former Governor Kevin Warsh. Powell could continue serving as a Fed governor until 2028, though previous Fed chairs had typically left the board early when their time as chair ended. Observers expected Powell to follow that tradition, especially after the Fed reappointed the regional presidents, easing fears that Trump would purge them to stack the Federal Open Market Committee with his loyalists. But Powell's forceful statement against the Justice Department probe makes that less likely. So, what have the market reactions been to this conflict between President Trump and the Fed? Here's an article, again from Fortune magazine, this time the 13th of January. It's by Eva Reutberg. The title is Stock Futures Slide While Gold and Silver Jump After Powell Investigation Raises Fears Over the Fed's Independence. U.S. equity futures fell sharply Sunday night after Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell confirmed that he's under investigation related to testimony he gave last June concerning the renovation of Federal Reserve buildings. The New York Times report breaking news of the investigation and Powell's subsequent disclosure rattled markets, reviving fears that years of President Donald Trump pressuring the Federal Reserve could now be realized into a direct assault on its independence. Futures tied to the NASDAQ 100 led the decline, falling about 0.8%, as interest rate-sensitive technology stocks bore the brunt of the sell-off. S&P 500 futures were down roughly 0.5%, while Dow Jones Industrial Average futures fell about 0.4%, according to late evening pricing. Investors sought protection in their traditional safe haven assets. Gold futures rose 1.7% to around $4,578 an ounce, while silver jumped more than 4%, reflecting renewed demand for protection against political and monetary instability. The U.S. dollar weakened modestly against several major currencies, including the Swiss franc and the Japanese yen. After years of largely staying silent while Trump repeatedly mocked and threatened him, Powell appeared to have reached a breaking point, issuing a rare and pointed statement. He wrote that while no one, certainly not the chair of the Federal Reserve, is above the law, the attack should be seen in the broader context of the administration's threats and ongoing pressure. This new threat is not about my testimony last June or about the renovation of the Federal Reserve buildings. Those are pretexts. The threat of criminal charges is a consequence of the Federal Reserve setting interest rates based on our best assessment of what will serve the public rather than following the preferences of the president. Economists warn that if the executive branch successfully co-opts the Fed, it could create a self-fulfilling prophecy of higher long-term inflation. As Oxford Economics recently noted, any cracks in the Fed's independence could spread rapidly through markets and ultimately raise borrowing costs for the businesses the administration seeks to protect with lower interest rates. In a note published last July, when Trump publicly threatened to fire Powell, Deutsche Bank warned that such a move could spark severe market disruption. Both the currency and the bond market can collapse, the bank wrote, citing heightened risks of inflation and financial instability. The empirical and academic evidence on the impact of a loss of central bank independence is fairly clear. Wall Street executives have echoed those concerns. Brian Moynihan, chief executive of Bank of America, said recently, "The erosion of Fed independence would carry serious consequences. The market will punish people if we don't have an independent Fed," Moynihan said. And here's our final article on the Fed and President Trump, dated January 12th, by Jim Edwards. Sell America, investors dump U.S. assets in fear of the end of Fed independence. Whoever replaces Jerome Powell as chairman of the U.S. Federal Reserve in May knows one thing. If they don't do what President Trump wants, they risk being criminally prosecuted. That was the unambiguous message in Powell's extraordinary statement yesterday, in which he vowed to continue to set monetary policy independently, regardless of the federal grand jury subpoenas investigating his statements to Congress about the alleged cost overruns in the renovation of the Fed's HQ building. This new threat is not about my testimony last June or about the renovation of the Federal Reserve buildings. Those are pretexts. The threat of criminal charges is a consequence of the Federal Reserve setting interest rates based on our best assessment of what will serve the public rather than following the preferences of the president, he said. This is about whether the Fed will be able to continue to set interest rates based on evidence and economic conditions, or whether monetary policy will be directed by political pressure or intimidation. Markets moved back into sell America mode overnight as traders digested the prospect of an incoming Fed chair who lacks independent credibility. The dollar sank 32 basis points against a basket of international currencies. The yield on five-year treasuries moved up sharply, a sign that investors now regard the U.S. government bonds as being suddenly more risky. Gold futures, the traditional safe haven, rose 2.21% today to hit a new record high of over $4,600 per troy ounce. And S&P futures are down 66 one-hundredths of a percent this morning prior to the opening bell. Wall Street analysts are almost universally negative about the news. The combined drop in the dollar, equities, and treasuries was a reminiscence of the Sell America days of last spring. ING's Francisco Pezzoli told clients this morning, "The downside risks for the dollar from any indications of further determination to interfere with the Fed's independence are substantial. Again, the bond market will be the most important barometer, both on the short end of the curve, if markets price back in more rate cuts, or in the long end, with potential stress signs on independence risks. A steep sharpening of the curve could kick the dollar on a fall." At Invesco Asset Management, analyst David Chow told Bloomberg, "The Fed subpoena is another example of how U.S. assets are becoming less attractive. Not only is the U.S. retrenching behind its Fortress America borders, the country is also becoming more predatory. The subpoenas may also trigger a burst of inflation, according to RBC Capital Markets' Blake Gwynn. Markets will start to price in greater inflation expectations, inflation risk premium, and term premium if the Fed's independence comes under further attack," he told the Financial Times. "We don't appear to have hit it yet, but every action is another step closer to it." Counterintuitively, some analysts think the investigation now makes near-term interest rate cuts less likely, because Powell and the other members of the Federal Open Markets Committee will be determined to show the markets that they are guided by the data and not legal threats. The move may also help Fed independence, UBS's Paul Donovan said in an email. Powell's defiance might signal a reluctance to quit as a Fed governor this year. There are signs the Senate may delay confirming the nomination of a new Fed chair. Concerns about market reactions and perceptions of institutional independence in the wake of legal challenges may become hawkish considerations in setting interest rates. ING's Pezzoli said, "Markets aren't ready to price in a loss of Fed independence just yet, either on the view that Powell will indeed remain firm in his policy views, as he's pledged to, the FOMC won't be heavily affected, or that the DOJ subpoenas aren't likely to lead to an indictment. Either way, there's a real sense of uncertainty among asset managers right now. The Fed, as we've understood it as an institution over the past couple of decades, is fading from view. It's operating in a different environment," ANZ's chief economist, Richard Yetsenga told the FT. From the Fed, we're moving over to oil. And this article deals with a meeting that President Trump had with the chief executive officers of our major oil companies. The article's by Jordan Bloom. It's dated the 13th of January, and it's from Fortune magazine. Trump threatens to keep too cute Exxon out of Venezuela after CEO provides reality check on uninvestable industry. As other oil executives lavished President Trump with praise at the White House, ExxonMobil CEO Darren Woods blatantly said the Venezuelan oil industry is currently uninvestable and that major reforms are required before even considering committing the many billions of dollars required to revitalize the country's dilapidated crude business. 2 days later, a MIF Trump told reporters January 11th that he would probably be inclined to keep Exxon out of Venezuela. I didn't like their response. They're playing too cute, Trump said. Woods, an Exxon lifer who succeeded Rex Tillerson as CEO in 2017 when his boss went to work for Trump, is a reserved but strong-spoken chief who's emerged as an unofficial industry spokesman as the leader of the world's biggest oil giant. But he's inadvertently crossed swords with the president who wants U.S. big oil players to invest more than $100 billion in the Venezuelan oil sector and to do it quickly. There was nobody to say anything except Darren, and he's eloquent as heck, said Jim Wicklund, veteran oil analyst and managing director for PPHB Energy Investment Firm, noting that Exxon's stock most likely would have fallen if Woods had overcommitted to Venezuela. This is Trump's problem. There is no urgency by industry at all to go back into Venezuela, and there's almost no inducement other than guaranteeing profitability, which they can't do, Wicklund said. You can sweeten the terms, but the political risk outweighs that variable by a factor of 10. We don't need Venezuelan oil. It's going to hurt everybody else, including U.S. producers, if we boost Venezuelan production, because right now we're awash in oil. But Trump also wants more oil to keep lowering prices, because it means cheaper prices at the pump to help win the midterm elections. Exxon and ConocoPhillips specifically had their Venezuelan oil assets expropriated by the government in 2007, costing them billions of dollars. Although Venezuela has the world's largest proven oil reserves, its oil output has plunged to one-third of its volumes from the turn of the century because of mismanagement, labor strikes, and U.S. sanctions. Trump has used the 2007 expropriations as a pretext for the shocking January 3rd military attack and arrest of leader Nicolas Maduro. Trump has repeatedly called the expropriations the largest theft in American history. He called an impressive group of global oil executives to the White House on January 9th to discuss how they will go into Venezuela, invest, and turn the industry around. But Woods, more than anyone, put a damper on Trump's enthusiasm to move fast and spend big. Woods promised to send a technical team to Venezuela within 2 weeks to assess the situation, but any major financial commitments would take much longer. The question will ultimately be, how durable are the protections from a financial standpoint? What do the terms look like? What are the commercial frameworks, the legal frameworks, Woods said. All those things have to be put in place in order to make a decision to understand what your return will be over the next several decades for these billions of dollars of investment. Exxon did not respond to requests for comments January 12th, and the White House declined further comment. Dan Pickering, founder of the Pickering Energy Partners, consulting and research firm, said he expected cheerleading from the oil executives, and they delivered in spades, except for Woods. If you only had to have one snippet about what's actually going to happen, Exxon gave it to you, Pickering said. We could have hung up after that. The reality, more than doubling Venezuela's current oil production likely would take until 2030 and cost about $110 billion, according to research firm Rystad Energy, while tripling back to levels from 2000 would take well over a decade and cost closer to $185 billion. ExxonMobil recently pioneered the oil industry offshore of Guyana, Venezuela's southern neighbor, and it makes more sense to keep investing there than to move back into Venezuela, Wicklund said. If you have the choice of committing capital to another well in Guyana, an offshore well in Brazil, making an acquisition in the Permian Basin, or spending $20 billion and waiting a couple of years to get an incremental drop of oil out of Venezuela, then it comes in last, Wicklund said. You must spend to rebuild the infrastructure in Venezuela long before it can return to profitability. And even though the oil is already discovered, it isn't cheap to produce because the extra heavy grade of Venezuelan crude requires extra effort to get out of the ground. Diluent, essentially a very light oil, is needed to thin it out and get the heavy crude to flow out of the wells. You're talking about having to bring in oil to get the oil out. It's basically sludge, Wicklund said. Maybe Woods could have sugarcoated his message a bit more, but he still did promise boots on the ground quickly, just not money, Wicklund said. He may regret saying that today, but none of it would have changed reality. That said, Trump remains in a position of strength in Venezuela because controlling the oil can force the acting Venezuelan government to cooperate. The U.S. doesn't need the oil, but it's a perfect way to control Venezuela, Wicklund said. Why did you leave everybody in place? Stability. They all hate you, yes. But now Trump owns the purse strings. It's kind of brilliant, and nature will take its course in the economics of the oil and gas industry. Our next article is about the Magnificent Seven, and we'll explain what that is as the article goes along. It's from Bloomberg and Fortune magazine, dated January 12th. Magnificent Seven's stock market dominance shows signs of cracking. To beat the market in recent years, many investors applied a simple strategy: load up on the biggest U.S. technology stocks. It paid handsomely for a long time, but last year it didn't. For the first time since 2022, when the Federal Reserve started raising interest rates, the majority of the Magnificent Seven tech giants performed worse than the S&P 500 index. While the Bloomberg Magnificent Seven index rose 25% in 2025, compared with 16% for the S&P 500. That was only because of the enormous gains by Alphabet Inc. and NVIDIA Corporation. Many Wall Street pros see that dynamic continuing in 2026. As profit growth slows and questions about payoffs from heavy artificial intelligence spending rise, so far they've been right, with the Magnificent Seven index up just 0.5% and the S&P 500 climbing 1.8% to start the year. Suddenly, stock picking within the group is crucial. This isn't a one-size-fits-all market, says Jack Janesiewicz, lead portfolio strategist at Natixis Investment Manager Solutions, which has $1.4 trillion in assets. If you're just buying the group, the losers could offset the winners. The three-year bull market has been led by the tech giants, with NVIDIA, Alphabet, Microsoft Corporation, and Apple Incorporated alone accounting for more than a third of the S&P 500 gains since the run began in October 2022. But enthusiasm for them is cooling as interest in the rest of the S&P 500 rises. With big tech's earnings growth slowing, investors are no longer content with promises of AI riches. They want to start seeing a return. Profits for the Magnificent Seven are expected to climb about 18% in 2026, the slowest pace since 2022, and not much better than the 13% rise projected for the other 493 companies in the S&P 500, according to data compiled by Bloomberg Intelligence. We're already seeing a broadening of earnings growth, and we think that's going to continue, said David Lefkowitz, head of U.S. equities at UBS Global Wealth Management. Tech is not the only game in town. One source of optimism is the group's relatively subdued valuations. The Magnificent Seven Index is priced at 29 times profits projected over the next 12 months, well below the 40s multiples earlier in the decade. The S&P 500 is trading at 22 times expected earnings, and the NASDAQ 100 index is at 25. Now, here's a look at expectations for the year ahead. Microsoft. For Microsoft, 2025 was the second consecutive year it underperformed the S&P 500. One of the biggest AI spenders, it's expected to invest nearly $100 billion in capital expenditures during its current fiscal year, which ends in June. That figure is projected to rise to $116 billion the following year, according to the average of analyst estimates. The data center build-out is fueling a resurgence in revenue growth in Microsoft's cloud computing business, but the company hasn't had much success in getting customers to pay for the AI services infused in its software products. Investors want to start seeing returns on those investments, according to Brian Mulberry, client portfolio manager at Zacks Investment Management. What you're seeing is some people looking for a little bit more quality management in terms of that cash flow management and a better idea on what profitability really looks like when it comes to AI, Mulberry said. Apple. Apple has been far less aggressive with its AI ambitions than the rest of the Magnificent Seven. The stock was punished for it last year, falling almost 20% through the start of August. But then it caught on as an anti-AI play, soaring 34% through the end of the year, as investors rewarded its lack of AI spending risk. At the same time, strong iPhone sales reassured investors that the company's most important product remains in high demand. Accelerating growth will be the key for Apple shares this year. Its momentum has slowed recently. The stock closed higher on Friday, narrowly avoiding matching its longest losing streak since 1991. However, revenue is expected to expand 9% in fiscal 2026, which ends in September, the fastest pace since 2021. With the stock valued at 31 times estimated earnings, the second highest in the Magnificent Seven after Tesla, it will need a push to keep the rally going. Alphabet. A year ago, OpenAI was seen as leading the AI race, and investors feared Alphabet would get left behind. Today, Google's parent is a consensus favorite, with dominant positions across the AI landscape. Alphabet's latest Gemini AI model received rave reviews, easing concerns about OpenAI, and its tensor processing unit chips are considered a potential significant driver of future revenue growth, which would eat into NVIDIA's commanding share of the AI semiconductor market. The stock rose more than 65% last year, the best performance in the Magnificent Seven. But how much more can it run? The company is approaching $4 trillion in market value, and the shares trade around 28 times estimated earnings, well above their five-year average of 20. The average analyst price target projects just a 3.9% gain this year. Amazon.com, the e-commerce and cloud computing giant, was the weakest Magnificent Seven stock in 2025. its seventh straight year in that position. But Amazon has charged out of the gate in early 2026 and is leading the pack. Much of the optimism surrounding the company is based on Amazon Web Services, which posted its fastest growth in years in the company's most recent results. Concerns that AWS was falling behind its rivals has pressured the stock, as has the company's aggressive AI spending, which includes efforts to improve efficiency at its warehouses, in part by using robotics. Investors expect the efficiency push to start paying off before long, which could make this the year the stock goes from laggard to leader. Automation in warehouses and more efficient shipping will be huge, said Clayton Allison, portfolio manager at Prime Capital Financial, which owns Amazon shares. It hasn't gotten the love yet, but it reminds me of Alphabet last year, which was sort of left behind amid all the concerns about competition from OpenAI and then really took off. Meta Platforms. Perhaps no stock in the group shows how investors have turned skeptical about lavish AI spending more than Meta. Chief Executive Officer Mark Zuckerberg has pushed expensive acquisitions and talent hires in pursuit of his AI ambitions, including a $14 billion investment in Scale AI, in which Meta also hired the startup CEO, Alexander Wang, to be its chief AI officer. The strategy was fine with the shareholders, until it wasn't. The stock tumbled in late October after Meta raised its 2025 capital expenditures forecast to $72 billion and projected notably larger spending in 2026. When the shares hit a record in August, they were up 35% for the year, but they've since dropped 17%. Demonstrating how that spending is boosting profits will be critical for Meta in 2026. And the last of the seven, Tesla. Tesla's shares were the worst performers in the Magnificent Seven through the first half of 2025, but then soared more than 40% in the second half as Chief Executive Officer Elon Musk shifted focus from slumping electrical vehicle sales to self-driving cars and robotics. The rally has Tesla's valuation at almost 200 times estimated profits, making it the second most expensive stock in the S&P 500 behind takeover target Warner Brothers Discover Incorporated. After 2 years of stagnant revenue, Tesla is expected to start growing again in 2026. Revenue is projected to rise 12% this year and 18% next year, following an estimated 3% contraction in 2025, according to data compiled by Bloomberg. Still, Wall Street is pessimistic about Tesla shares this year. The average analyst price target projects a 9.1% decline over the next 12 months, data compiled by Bloomberg Show. Perhaps you've read that over the next year, Donald Trump wants to cap credit card interest at 10%. Here's an article analyzing the ramifications of how that might affect the business of large financial institutions. The article's from Fortune Magazine, January 12th, written by Preston Foer. Trump wants to cap credit card interest rates at 10%, but such limits could harm consumers, experts warn. Credit cards are the sharpest double-edged sword in Americans' personal finance arsenal. They can be indispensable tools for coping with financial hardship, a great way to finance your family vacation, or a free pass granting access to luxury lounges at the airport. But for many consumers, they can also be a debt trap with no escape. Like Robin Hood in reverse, credit card companies take the interest payments from those who carry a balance and redistribute them as rewards that benefit people who don't, Sky-high annual percentage rates, APRs, on U.S. credit cards are worsening the debt trap for those who carry a balance. 4 years ago, the average APR was less than 15%. By 2024, it was over 21%, and a growing number of Americans are finding themselves with interest rates over 30%. On Friday, President Donald Trump called for a one-year cap on credit card interest rates at 10%, effective January 20th. That comes after Senator Bernie Sanders and Josh Hawley introduced a bill last year that would cap credit card interest rates at 10% for 5 years. On the campaign trail, Trump supported the idea, despite stark opposition from the banks and credit unions that issue credit cards. When large financial institutions charge over 25% interest on credit cards, they are not engaged in the business of making credit available. They are engaged in extortion and loan sharking, stated Sanders in a press conference. The bill aims to curb the profits that flow from credit card lending and provide financial relief for working families. However, if passed, the measure would likely reduce easy access to credit and also undercut the credit card rewards that power the industry. Whenever the Congress imposes new regulations on the economy, second and third order effects often create unintended consequences, experts and industry groups told Fortune last year. By solving the problem of high credit card APRs, a rate cap could very well end up hurting those it was intended to help. Credit card interest rates vary widely, depending on the unique risk profile of each cardholder, limiting banks' ability to charge rates commensurate with historic default levels would likely send shockwaves throughout the industry. Jennifer Doss, executive editor at CardRatings.com, explains that cards with high APRs give banks the option to offer credit to people who might not otherwise qualify. Credit card companies typically charge higher interest rates to mitigate higher perceived risk, she said. Consequently, individuals with lower credit scores generally face higher interest rates. John Cable, Managing Director of Payments Intelligence at J.D. Power, adds that rate caps could make it economically unviable for issuers to provide credit to people who struggle with delinquency. If you're forced to cap APRs for those with the highest interest rates, it would no longer make sense for the issuer to even offer them a product, because it might not even be net positive from a revenue perspective, he said. Consumers denied access to credit cards by interest rate caps would still need access to credit. They could end up opting for payday loans or similar options that carry even more expensive rates than high-interest credit cards. Research clearly shows that when politicians, rather than the free market, dictate prices, consumers ultimately pay the price through limited choices outside the well-regulated banking system, said Consumer Bank Association President and CEO Lindsay Johnson. Capping credit card rates would also likely dampen credit card rewards. If you've ever redeemed points or miles for a flight or a hotel stay, you've benefited from high credit card interest rates. That's because the revenue generated by interest payments on card balances helps to power the ecosystem of points, miles, and cashback rewards. According to Cable, cardholders who never carry a balance need to understand that their expectations of getting something for nothing carries a steep cost for other consumers. Higher net worth individuals are consuming all of those perks at the cost of the lower-end consumers who don't benefit, he said. Consumers who reap the most rewards from credit cards don't pay interest. Federal research shows has found that every year, a whopping $15 billion is transferred from those who carry a balance and redistributed to those who earn rewards. Credit card payment fees on retail transactions, some of which are as high as 4%, are another source of support for card rewards, and some experts believe swipe fees could have a more direct financial connection to the reward system. However, a separate bill in Congress is taking aim at high swipe fees. The proposed Credit Card Competition Act, a bipartisan bill introduced in 2024 by Senators Dick Durbin and Roger Marshall, targets the dominance of payment processors Visa and MasterCard, which together took in $93 billion in credit card swipe fees in 2022. The bill would require large financial institutions to allow at least two credit card payment processing networks to be used on their credit cards, and one of them cannot be Visa or MasterCard. This would give merchants greater flexibility to choose payment networks and, it's hoped, reduce the swipe fees. If both bills were passed, the reduction in revenue from interest payments and swipe fees would likely be the final straw for credit card rewards programs. Okay, enough about credit cards. How many of you have shopped at Saks or Neiman Marcus? Here's an article about what's happened to Saks since they took over Neiman Marcus. It's from Fortune magazine by way of the Associated Press, and it's dated January 14th. The owner of Saks Fifth Avenue is seeking bankruptcy protection, buffeted by rising competition and the massive debt it took on to buy its rival in the luxury sector, Neiman Marcus, just over a year ago. Saks Global has secured roughly $1.75 billion in financing, the New York company said, as filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy Wednesday in the Southern District of Texas. The private company said that stores will remain open as it restructures company debt, meaning that it will honor the programs it has for customers. Suppliers and employees will be paid, Saks said. This is a defining moment for Saks Global, and the path ahead presents a meaningful opportunity to strengthen the foundation of our business and position it for the future, said Jeffrey von Raemdonk, who took over for CEO and Executive Chairman Richard Baker this week. Baker had assumed control after the company's CEO, Mark Metrick, stepped down earlier this month. When Saks said that it would buy Neiman Marcus for $2.65 billion in the summer of 2024, the goal was to create a powerhouse in the luxury sector that had grown more fragmented. Online sellers were siphoning customers, and big-name brands had begun to sell goods from their own stores. But the tie-up with Neiman Marcus only worsened Saks' debt situation as luxury sales weakened. Global sales of luxury goods are expected to contract for the second straight year in 2026, as consumers anxious about the global economy pare back their spending, according to a study by Bain & Company Consultancy released in November. Hudson's Bay, Canada's oldest company, began liquidating all but six of its stores in March 2025. The upscale department store landscape has been volatile in recent years. Neiman Marcus entered bankruptcy protection for about 4 months in 2020 as the coronavirus pandemic spread. The privately held department store chain was forced to close its stores for several months during the pandemic, like other competitors such as Lord & Taylor. Lord & Taylor sought bankruptcy protection in August of that year, then said it would close all of its stores and operate as an online retailer only. The century-old department store Nordstrom agreed to be taken private by Nordstrom family members and a Mexican retail group in a $6.25 billion deal last year. Sales at the long-suffering Macy's have begun to improve under new CEO Tony Spring, who has shuttered unprofitable stores and improved service. He's also trying to attract the same luxury shoppers who power sales at Bloomingdale's and upscale beauty retailers Blue Mercury, which are both owned by Macy's. There is concern among vendors about Saks and how things will move forward. They're very, very nervous, very concerned, very worried about spring deliveries for merchandise they've already produced, said Gary Wassner, CEO of Hilden Corporation, which ensures suppliers get paid for products shipped to retailers. They weren't able to complete deliveries on what they'd produced for the fourth quarter of 2025, so they're sitting on that inventory. Wassner said Saks Global accounted for 40-50% of the business of some of his clients. He said that he told his clients to stop shipping to Saks last month, given the uncertainty. Saks says that it has financing commitments of $1.5 billion from some of its creditors and another $240 million in incremental liquidity from its lenders. So, we've talked about credit card debt. We've talked about the bankruptcy of Saks. Now we're going to talk about the national debt. This is an article by Eleanor Pringle from Fortune magazine dated January 12th. Treasury spent $276 billion in interest on the national debt in the final 3 months of 2025, says the CBO, up $30 billion from a year prior. The Treasury paid out $92 billion a month in net interest on the national debt in the final 3 months of 2025, the Congressional Budget Office reported. That's 13% higher than the year prior. In its monthly budget review for September, released Friday, the CBO reported that budget outlays for October to December included a $276 billion spend on net interest on the public debt, up $31 billion from the same period at the close of 2024. The reason is straightforward. The CBO reported interest payments were higher because the value of the debt was larger in the final 3 months of 2025, which coincides with the first 3 months of the 2026 financial calendar beginning in October. For the fiscal year of 2025, ending in September, the government spent $1.22 trillion on interest alone per Treasury data. Additionally, the costs were higher because of higher long-term interest rates and an increase in the rate of inflation. Conversely, declines in the short-term interest rate partially mitigated the overall rise in payments. Moving into 2026, the Treasury's budget will get little relief from the rising cost of America's $38.4 trillion national debt burden. While the short-term base rate decreased, thanks to cuts from the Fed last year, analysts are widely expecting the base rate to decrease at a slower pace in the new year. For example, Polymarket's odds that at the next Federal Open Market Committee, the FOMC, that meeting in a little over a fortnight's time will result in no change currently sits at 95%, meaning they don't think there's going to be a rate cut by the Fed. Meanwhile, the likelihood of a 25 basis point cut from the current rate of 3.5 to 3.75% sits at approximately 4%. CME's FedWatch index shows similar odds. Elsewhere, the CBO's preliminary projections for inflation suggest some relief may be in the cards. In its View of the Economy report released last week, the nonpartisan organization wrote that it expects price increases to slow this year. The core PCE price index will likely sit at 3.2%. on an annual rate of quarter one in 2026, and down to 2.9%, 2.7%, and 2.5% for the following three quarters, it said. 2026 will also be a potentially pivotal year for government budgets. President Trump had earmarked tariff revenue to offset or even pay down the national debt, Since then, the plan has gone somewhat awry, with the Oval Office instead promising various cash payments to the American people. Separately, the U.S. Supreme Court will soon rule on the legality of the tariffs themselves. This, said the American Enterprise Institute's Desmond Lockman, is a significant concern. Speaking to Fortune last week, Lockman said the budget situation is really very bad. He added, the biggest threats to the budget include the Supreme Court is hearing a case, and one would expect they can be ruling within the next few months that they can reverse all of Trump's tariffs that he introduced on a national emergency basis. That would really be a very big hit to the budget. The other thing that would add to the budget in really a very big way is Trump's promise to give people $2,000 using the import tariffs revenues that he's going to get. Those are really big factors. The federal budget is headed in the right direction. The CBO reported that the deficit totaled $601 billion in the first quarter of the fiscal year 2026, which is $110 billion less than the deficit recorded the same period last year. This was because revenues rose by $141 billion, while outlays were $31 billion higher, precisely the same amount as the increase in interest payments. Some of that reduction came from a decrease in spending. Outlays from the Environmental Protection Agency decreased by $19 billion, or 81%, CBO estimates, because a year prior, the department invested $20 billion under a clean energy grant program. Likewise, spending by the Department of Homeland Security decreased by $12 billion, primarily because the Federal Emergency Management Act spent more for hurricane relief during the same period last fiscal year. However, the biggest offset came from customs duties, including that all-important tariff revenue. This fiscal year, the CBO said, duties were more than four times the amount recorded in the first 3 months of last year, an increase of $70 billion. Our next article talks about the productivity in the United States and the overall state of the economy. It's by Cheryl Estrada from Fortune magazine, dated January 12th. Good morning. The U.S. economy closed out 2025 with a puzzling mix, sluggish job growth aside accelerating productivity. The U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, the BLS, reported on Friday that non-farm payrolls rose by a seasonally adjusted 50,000 in December 2025, missing the 73,000 Dow Jones estimate and slowing from November's revised gain of 56,000. November payrolls were revised down by 8,000 jobs, while October's loss deepened to 173,000 from 105,000. For 2025 as a whole, payrolls grew by an average of 49,000 jobs per month, down sharply from 168,000 in 2024. Bank of America Global Research analysts wrote in a report on Friday that although payroll growth has slowed since June, the unemployment rate has risen by only about 11 basis points. The report noted, "We've been highlighting that tighter immigration restrictions are likely to play a bigger role in the slowdown in job growth this year." The unemployment rate is a key statistic for the Fed, and markets responded to Friday's miss by pricing out a January rate cut, according to the analysts. Futures now imply less than half a cut priced in through April, which marks the end of Powell's term. Despite weaker job growth, forecasts still point to a solid overall economic expansion. I asked Gregory Dako, EY chief economist, how the U.S. economy can continue to grow strongly while hiring softens. "We're seeing a clear decoupling between growth and hiring," Dako said. "Output is still expanding, but companies are generating that growth with fewer incremental workers and fewer hours. Productivity has rebounded meaningfully as businesses continue to streamline operations, automate processes, and extract more output from existing teams in a high-cost, high-interest rate environment, Deco explains. This isn't AI-led in a narrow sense yet. It's the payoff from multi-year efficiency drives, tighter cost discipline, and delayed hiring. According to the BLS, non-farm business sector labor productivity increased 4.9% in the third quarter of 2025, as output rose 5.4%, while hours worked increased just 0.5%. Areas of job growth. Where job growth has occurred, employment in food services and drinking places continued to trend higher in December, adding 27,000 jobs. The sector added an average of 12,000 jobs monthly in 2025. Healthcare employment also continued its upward trend in December, rising by 21,000 jobs, including a gain of 16,000 in hospitals. Healthcare added an average of 34,000 jobs per month in 2025, down from an average monthly increase of 56,000 in 2024. As private payroll growth weakened through 2025 and hiring appetites diminished, I asked Deco whether he expects the trend to continue amid ongoing geopolitical uncertainty and tariff-related risks. Yes, barring a material improvement in policy clarity, I expect hiring restraint to persist, he said. Hiring hasn't stopped, but it's become more selective and more conditional on a clear demand visibility, Deco added. In this environment, CFOs are likely continuing to favor efficiency, automation, and CapEx discipline over broad-based workforce expansion. Folks, that's the end of the article, and it's all we have time for today. Thank you so much for listening. This is Sun Sounds of Arizona. The program is Business World, and I'm Steve Klein. See you next Monday at 11 a.m. Bye for now.